You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Savage Arms and the new 110 Ultralight. At about 6 pounds, the 110 Ultralight is designed to combat elevation and the elements while maintaining the performance of a factory blueprinted Savage 110 action. The carbon fiber wrapped stainless steel barrel makes it durable and lightweight. The rifle comes equipped with the Savage AccuFit technology, so that means it's adjustable and it comes in a variety of calibers. The 308, the 270, the 28 Nosler, the 280 Ackley Improved, the 30-06, and much more. If you want to find out more information about the 110 Ultralight, visit savagearms.com.
This is the Houndsman XP Podcast.
Good dog, get that bear. Get that bear in here.
The original podcast for the complete Houndsman. The podcast that represents our lifestyle of extreme performance.
Get out of
there! Get him! Get him! Yeah! Good boy!
Good boy, Ranger!
Uniting houndsmen across the globe, from east to west, north to south.
You know, if you're going to catch a cat or a lion, you know, you have to have teamwork.
We take you to the wildest places on earth.
Yeah, so how many days a week do you spend out there?
As much as I can, to be honest with you. Anytime that I get, I'm out there.
Join us for every heart-pounding adventure on Houndsman XP.
I'll tell you like I tell everyone else, I'm going to hunt whether you're here or not, so you might as well be here.
In this episode of Houndsman XP, I have a very special guest, you guys. My friend Alex and I have been talking for a while. He's a curator of several hound hunting groups on Facebook. He's a very intelligent, articulate man, and he's been hound hunting in Australia for a very long time. He was also super instrumental in getting sambar hunting back with hounds in Australia after it had been banned. I really enjoyed talking to Alex. We talked about so many different topics, about houndsmanship of old and how it's changed, and just how we view modern houndsmanship, you know, from both the lens of someone who's been doing it for decades and someone who's just getting started, me. And so I just really love talking to people like that, have this wealth of knowledge, and they have their eyes focused on making sure that we preserve, protect, and promote our great heritage. Alex has been an incredibly humble and kind fan of the show, and I reached out to him and asked if he wanted to be on the show, and he was very happy to oblige. Before we get there, guys, I just wanted to take a quick moment to talk about some of my friends of HXP. I want to start with Paws Are Protected. Paws Are Protected is a preconditioning salve that you put on your dog's feet. It helps keep their feet really strong, yet soft and moisturized. I use it on my running dog's feet. I actually just had a pretty bad cut on one of my dog's feet. I've been using it for the last 2 weeks on it to keep it in shape, and it's recovered really nicely. You can't even tell. The pad was lacerated by a rock. Actually, my male dislocated one of his toes, and although I wish Paws Are Protected could heal that quicker, that will just take time. But he also cut some feet. That hair took him through some pretty rough stuff. His paws looking a lot better, and must have been a pretty gnarly rock to cut his feet, because normally he doesn't sustain much damage. I put Paws Are Protected on his paws regularly to help keep them in great shape. If you join us on Patreon, guys, you can get a code for 20% off Paws Are Protected, which is our way of saying thank you to both Paws Are Protected and as a thank you to you guys for joining us on Patreon. And if you're like, what's Patreon? Patreon's a website that allows you to make a monthly donation to Hounds and XP, and in return, not only are you supporting the best hound hunting podcast in the world, but you're also getting access to sweet behind-the-scenes footage, articles that we write, cool tailgate talks, which are like extra mini podcasts that are just super casual. We talk with friends of the show. And I'm dead serious, guys. If you want to be on a tailgate talk with me, reach out to me. I'd love to have you on the show and talk. I love talking to the fans. It's pretty much my favorite thing to do as a member of the HXP team. So reach out to me. Let's have a talk. We also have pro training tips from our friends like Jared Moss and Chris. We have all kinds of sweet articles and even recipes on how to cook and prepare some native shrubbery and wild game. So it's just something that is a way to connect with other houndsmen and women that want to be part of a community that's a little bit more than just listening to the show. And it helps us keep the lights on and make sure we keep our production value at the tip top and always stay improving. And so to our patrons that are listening, we really appreciate it. And if you're curious, you can go to houndzonexp.com, click on the Patreon tab. It'll take you right there to Patreon. Or you can go to patreon.com and search up in the top right search bar for Houndsman XP. Pick the tier that you want to support Houndsman XP at. And there you go. And like I said, we really appreciate your time. And lastly, guys, I really did want to throw out a shout out to Freedom Hunters. Freedom Hunters is a great friend of the podcast. We've hosted Freedom Hunters event. You can also host your own Freedom Hunters event. And Freedom Hunters is an organization that gets wounded veterans and Gold Star family members and veterans of all types back out in the field. And of course, when they partner with Hounds and XP, we cater towards hound hunting events, but they can do all kinds of different stuff. And I just think it's a great cause. All of us do here at HXP, and I think we can all agree that getting anybody out in the field, especially America's heroes, back out and experiencing the outdoors in ways that maybe they couldn't or for the first time ever is awesome and super important. So check out Freedom Hunters, you guys. It's at freedomhunters.org, and you can get all the information you need there. They're a great friend of the podcast and definitely someone we can all get behind. Okay, guys, well, we're heading back down under. Let's gear up for a great podcast with my friend Alex Kierstick. Here we go. Thanks again for listening. Hey, everybody, how's it going? Welcome to the Hounds and XP podcast. Today, I have a very special guest with me. He's a guest that a lot of people have requested, and I was very happy to reach out to my friend Alex. And without further ado, why don't you introduce yourself, Alex, and tell everyone hello to the Hounds and XP world.
Hey, hi, Seth. Greetings from the land down under, Australia. I'm very humbled to have been invited to speak on this podcast. I've been an avid fan for quite a long time. Look, my background basically is I've been a hunter and a houndsman for pretty well my entire adult life. I'm 62 years of age now, and I started hunting with dogs as a kid, you know, as a 10 or 11 year old. So I'm starting to get the hang of a few things.
Just a little bit, huh?
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, every day that goes past and every day you spend in the bush, you realize how much you don't know.
I've heard that a lot from very experienced people, and I really love that saying. I want to use that a couple decades down the line.
Oh, well, hopefully we'll all be around in a couple of decades' time doing what we like.
Go ahead.
Here in Australia,
No problem.
Here in Australia, we're avid sportsmen and hunters. Hunting with dogs has been a tradition for as long as as long as humans have been in Australia. That also includes our Indigenous people who actually hunt. And they still hunt with dogs in their traditional lands. But since the white man came here, they've always hunted with dogs and hounds, everything from scent hounds right through to sight hounds like yours. Mm-hmm. And the tradition continues. My main concentration as far as hounds are concerned are scent hounds. I also hunt with and breed with terriers and German hunting terriers or Jarg terriers and Deutsch Drahthaars, which are known in some places as German wirehairs or German wirehair pointers. Mm-hmm. I'm a retired police officer. I've got 30 years service veteran of the Victoria Police.
Wow.
Currently, I run a couple of businesses. I run a professional hunting outfit and also a wildlife control company, as well as a ballistics testing laboratory. So we test armor and things like that for various organizations, the military and for the police.
You're living the dream. Holy smokes.
Maybe one day I'll make some money out of it.
Yeah, that's how I feel as a wildlife biologist. I'm having fun, but man, I'm glad I married an engineer. She makes all the real money.
I'm very lucky to have a professional wife as well. And she keeps me in the manner in which to which I've become accustomed.
Yes, I'm kind of a spoiled sugar baby in a way.
Oh, cool. I hear that your wife's a climber.
She is, big time. She is, you know, I've gotten into climbing secondhand through her. And yeah, I'm nowhere as good as her. Everyone thinks, because like, I don't know, I'm not like the biggest dude in the world, but everyone thinks that when we show up to the rocks that I'm going to be the one like climbing a bunch. And I'm like, nah, I just kind of watch her go, and she's really good. And yeah, we've been planning a trip to Australia for our honeymoon for some time. And this was way before I got on this show, and have made tons of Australian friends from like all over the country. And so now,
keep going.
Oh, and now I don't know if I'm going to be able to climb or if I'm just going to be able to hunt dogs the entire time.
I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunity for both. We have some fantastic climbing here at Mount Arapiles down in Victoria, down in the Western District here, and people from all over the world come and enjoy climbing there. And the good thing about it is it's only a relatively short distance away from some of the best hound hunting on Samba in the world.
So I want to do that so bad. That looks so fun. I knew dog driving was obviously a thing, but there's just something so alluring about hunting such a large deer like that. That's awesome.
the whole package with hunting Samba with stand hounds is magnificent. You know, some of the most beautiful country in the world here. We hunt on the Great Dividing Range, which runs down the entire eastern seaboard of Australia. But the area that we hunt in is way down south, right down in Victoria, which is the south eastern corner. Mm-hmm. And that's where these deer were, or in that area is where the deer were released back in the 1800s. And they've been hunted there ever since. Their numbers are certainly increasing.
Wow.
And the popularity of hound hunting is also increasing. Which is great.
You know, I think I'm going to be famous on HXP for the Australian guy, but I don't know what it is about you Aussies, but you guys are just great fans. You guys reach out and talk to me a bunch. And I was really excited to have you on the show, Alex, because almost everyone I talked to, A, had something very positive to say about you. B, was like, you need to have this guy on the show. And C, told me that you were very instrumental on keeping hound sports and the hound lifestyle in Australia going strong, or resurrecting it in places. And I really wanted to get to that. You know, I took a tiny look at your personal page, as well as the two pages that you moderate, Hounds Australia and Hounds Unlimited. And right there on the about section, you're talking about how the goal of your pages is to preserve, protect, and promote, in your own words, and how the whole point is to make sure that people are getting involved legislatively to help keep hound hunting alive. So first of all, thank you for your service. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. Preserving, protecting, and promoting the lifestyle is our goal here at Houndsman XP, obviously. And we love to see other individuals that are taking leadership positions. And so thank you. Really, I mean that.
Oh, well, I've drawn a lot of pleasure from hunting with hounds for all those years, and I think it's probably only fitting that I put a little back and try to preserve it.
I really wanted to hear your story about. I heard that sambar hunting became illegal. That's what Corbin said, and it was brought back. did you have anything to do with that?
Oh, look, it's a very, very long story. As in the US, here in Australia, we're constantly battling, I suppose, concentrated efforts to try to put us out of the bush, try to stop us from using our hounds for hunting. There are those that are very well organised and very capable at trying to quell what we're doing. Animal welfare groups, HSUS, PETA, RSPCA, pretty well, you know, the usual suspects. But from time to time, without getting too political, but unfortunately we're sort of forced into being a bit political these days, from time to time, governments or state governments get in, become elected, and they have agendas to do things. You know, they cut down areas that we can hunt. There's hound hunting is very, very highly regulated here in Victoria. It's regulated to the level where it's all it's very, very onerous. And as a result of that, I think they're trying to do everything they possibly can to keep us out of the bush.
Yeah, it's like making ammunition so expensive that you can't shoot your guns. Like that kind of legislation, it sounded like Corbyn was explaining. It's amazing.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. But also, for instance, the wildlife game regulations, which are the regulations that control hunting with dogs or hunting game anywhere in Australia, or in Victoria, sorry. The species that we hunt here, believe it or not, we are not allowed to hunt any native animals in Victoria at all with hounds or dogs or anything. The only animals we hunt here are introduced species, you know, things like the various deer species, of which there are several, foxes, rabbits, feral cats, dogs, and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'll concentrate on the Samba deer at this stage because they, by far, are the most coveted game animal in Australia and in Victoria in particular. And they are introduced and they've been declared as being a threatening process throughout, you being a scientist would be across this, throughout their range here in Victoria. And they do cause considerable damage to various ecosystems and things like that. But notwithstanding any of that, due to, I suppose, hunter behaviour or bad behaviour in the past from a very small number of people, hound hunting came under the microscope. And it got to the stage where the then left-wing government back in the late 90s decided that they were going to have a crack at banning hunting with hounds. So a few people got together and negotiated a few deals and tried to do a few things, and eventually we escaped losing hound hunting. But the trade-off was that the regulations had to become more and more onerous, and they have not. That's not stopped. The regulations keep increasing, or the level of regulation is increased significantly. So every hound, there's three classes of dog that you can use to hunt game in Victoria. One is gun dogs, which includes all the versatile breeds, you know, the German wire hairs, German short hairs, Vizslas, whoever would want to use a Vizsla for hunting. and then you go over to the deer hunting dogs, which is an unusual category, and this is in the schedule under the regulations, which includes Yark Terriers, Jack Russell Terriers, and various other small breeds of dogs. And then you go to the hounds, and then they stipulate what breeds of hounds we can use. And they also stipulate that each hound must be assessed and registered. And it's going to be assessed for its suitability to comply with the ANKC, which is the Australian Kennel Council's confirmation, and also for its suitability as far as temperament is concerned for hunting deer or hunting sambar in particular.
That's and a lot. Holy moly.
It is a very, very onerous system. And, look, we all know that, you know, nobody wants their hounds to hunt trash or non-target species.
Of course.
But it's the same. They keep wheeling out the fact that, oh, no, they could be chasing kangaroos and wallabies, and we don't want that to happen. Mm. You know, the first thing that any of us as hunters do is stop our hounds from chasing anything other than what we're actually hunting.
Yeah, of course. Did you guys lose the right to hunt sambar deer and then it was brought back? Or has it just been getting eroded more intensely over the years?
Well, it got to the precipice. It got to the cliff and it was about to go over. And there were things done that I suppose through the hunting community, not so much the hound hunting community, that stopped them from banning hunting with hounds totally. But the regulations were introduced and tightened up, and that's where we've wound up today. Look, we've made a little bit of ground back through a considerable amount of lobbying and work from certain groups within the hound hunting community, and we've actually in the last few years have been allowed to use harriers as scent hounds on sambar. Because when they banned the breed, the foxhound breed, for various reasons, relying on inverted commas anecdotal evidence to support their arguments. But when you research exactly what that anecdotal evidence is, it seems to be fairly short on evidence and long on rhetoric.
Of course.
Yeah. But anyway, we got harriers back, and they stipulate that you can use harriers, which pretty well are like a small sort of walker hound that you guys would be used to using. And I've sent you some photographs of some of ours, so hopefully you can see the type of hound that we use. You can also see it on our Facebook pages and various forums.
Yes, sir.
So we're constantly battling. And look, the hound hunting community is not without its issues as well, you know. We're made up of a cross-section of the community, and there's really great people involved, and there's also some not-so-great people involved, and everything in between.
Yep, as with any community.
Yeah. Yes, of course. And we've also got organisations that probably aren't pulling in the same direction, and sometimes we do things to our own detriment as far as the way, you know, the management of some of those organisations conduct themselves. But these are the sort of things that we're desperately trying to address and to try to get some sort of cogent or some sort of strong backing for hounds and keeping us in the bush.
So what happened when you guys gained ground back? I'm just curious as to that process. Was there hunting groups that all came together on the behalf of houndsmen? Was you guys a united sportsman's front, or was it literally just hound groups lobbying and coming together? Like, explain that process, because I think this is super important for American houndsmen to hear that you can get to the brink and still come back from it. And I just want to know how you guys did it, like specifically. Well,
There isn't really a formal, I suppose, hound group that you could call them a group here in Victoria. There is an association that represents hounds and hounds hunting, but unfortunately, they tend not to go far enough with regards to the advocacy and the lobbying side of things, and it's run more like a social family type of arrangement. Mm-hmm. And look, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. And there's been some very good things that have come out of that. There's also the various deer associations, the Australian Deer Association, which I'll remind them was formed by hound hunters. But at this stage, hound hunters seem to be the red-headed stepchild of the the deer hunting community.
And here in the United States too. Yeah. That's something we're always trying to battle. Nothing is more rewarding to me in the hunting community than convincing big game hunters that hound hunting is awesome. Like even people that have a neutral or even slightly negative view, after they spend some time with me, see my hair coursing dogs, even come out in the field with me and see those dogs coursing game, the look on their faces when they're like, this is absolutely awesome and totally different than I thought it was going to be. It feels amazing. And to me, that's what it's all about.
Well, I think you're quite correct. We're never going to get the antis on side, no matter what we do or say. They're anti-hunting and they're going to stay anti-hunting in most cases. But there are a lot of people that are undecided, and the silent majority of people, they tend to sit on the fence, or they're a little bit ambivalent about the whole thing. They're the ones that we need to get on side, and they need to understand that what we're doing isn't sinister or nasty or horrible. It's just what people have been doing with dogs since the beginning of time, and it's not a bad thing.
You know, it's funny to me that most people, especially non-hunting people that are just kind of completely ignorant or on the fence or anything about hound hunting, the first question they typically ask is, well, do the dogs have fun? And I'm like, oh my gosh, like it's what they're made to do. It's everything to them. They're having so much fun. And that fact alone is, I think, what attracts the most people to have positive views on the hound hunting. Even the intense bonds we have with our hounds, how much we really care about them, and the even individual bonds we form with the dogs. But just, when people just see how happy the dogs are to be doing what they love, that has been the biggest ally of houndsmanship. And I think moving forward, because the anti-hunting community really uses the quote unquote cruelty factor as shock images. And I think we need to use the positive emotions as our ally, the positive emotion of pride, taking care of our animals, the positive emotion of the bond and love we feel for the land, the game, and the dogs, as well as our lifestyle. And when people see how much we care about all of those things I just mentioned, plus how much fun our dogs, they just love being alive and doing a job, I think that's our biggest ally to move forward, in my opinion.
Look, I couldn't agree with you more. It's probably the most important thing. People do need to understand, and I think the vast majority of people that know hunters and houndsmen know just how well loved and well looked after their dogs are, and the measure of a good houndsman or a good hunter, man that hunts with dogs, is really by the way in which he looks after his dogs.
You never see a top
class hound team with average looking dogs. You know, their dogs look the part. They're well looked after. They're fit. They're healthy. They're in good condition. You know,
totally and agree.
They're our ambassadors. You know, and. And when people see hounds tied out along on a campsite where we're camping, they'll often come up and have a look, and they'll pat the dogs, and the dogs demonstrate that they're not savage, animal eating creatures. They're just dogs, you know.
Yeah.
You can come up and they wag their tail, and you can pat them, and they're easy going sort of dudes, and that's the image that we very much want to put across, and. By and large, that's the image that we do put across.
I agree very much. You know, I've had more positive experiences because I hunt on a lot of public land on foot. And one of the big advantages of hunting on foot is that my hounds are out with me. And a lot of times antelope hunters, or very rarely people out walking or enjoying themselves, but ranchers and people out there will see and they'll stop. And of course, my dogs are wagging their tails and they're coming up to people and licking their faces. And everyone's like, hunting dogs. These are hunting dogs. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And they're like, wow, I thought hunting dogs were mean or something. And I was like, yeah, no, they're dogs. Like, they love people. Like, you know what I mean? And I hunt hares with my dogs. So, I mean, it's easier for people to make that connection between the predator prey. You know what I mean? The predator and prey balance, because a hare is like a quintessential prey animal. So it's easy for people to make that bridge between like, oh, okay, yeah, these are just hunting dogs for rabbits. I think it's our predator houndsmen that really need to show that these dogs are, because every mountain lion dog I've ever met is super friendly. Like they just want to lick you and hang out like any normal dog. And I think they are the ones that, you know, need to put in the, not, I don't want to say need to put in the time, but definitely benefit from showing that they're just great pets as well as hound hunt, like hounds. You know what I mean?
Of course. Of course. Look, I've been very fortunate in my life where I've had the opportunity to travel to the US and hunt with houndsmen over there. And what you say is 100% correct. You know, the guys that I've hunted lions and bear with have been really the soul of the earth, and no different to the guys that I've hunted here my whole life with. You know, we just happen to be in a different part of the world hunting different critters, but we still love those dogs. There's a lot in common as far as the dogs are concerned, as far as the men and women are concerned that are involved. You know, I went over to the US back in the late 80s, and I thought I knew a little bit about hound hunting, and then I got over there and I realized just how much I didn't know about hound hunting.
That's how I feel being a part of this show. You know what I mean? I didn't think I knew that much to begin with. Yeah. Where'd you go in the United States?
It's a good eye-opener. Traveling and interacting with hunters all over the place is a good eye-opener, and I learned a hell of a lot from some of my friends in Virginia and down in Florida and some up in Oregon. And they're kind enough to assist us in what we're doing here, assisting with, bloodlines of dogs and, you know, transporting dogs and frozen semen and all sorts of stuff. And, mm-hmm. It's fantastic. And I think, you know, I listened to Steve Fielder and you guys talking about, all the positive stuff you're doing for the hounds and for the hound hunting community. And it really gives me it heartens me to think, well, you know, we're all on the same page here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to keep going. We're not going to stop.
But, and I think I agree with you. You know, you told me off air that that Australia has lost a lot more ground than we have in the United States. And I just want to make sure we stay on the vanguard of not losing ground, because I just think that keeping abreast of current issues and putting our best foot forward always and showing the world what houndsmanship is really like is going to be our best ally moving forward. And I just want to ask you, when you were in, what were you hunting in Florida with hounds?
Well, it was funny. I was actually the police force had sent me over there to do some courses with your federal government organizations, you know, to do with weapons and training and tactical stuff. And,
I was going to say, it's probably not the same courses that I'm talking about.
No. And all that gunslinger stuff, you know. And we started off in Quantico in Virginia, and I met a guy who's and I've got to be a bit careful about dropping names here.
Sure. Yeah, protect the names of the innocent.
Yeah. I met a guy who was one of your elite federal organizations, and he came from Florida, and his dad was a houndsman. And he said, you want to come and see, and you're a hunter and a houndsman, you better come down and visit my dad, and he'll take you hunting. You know, and when we went down there, my eyes were opened, and I met my first genuine redneck. And this guy was in his 70s then. He's passed away now, but he had beautiful walker hounds, and he had some blue ticks, and he kept these special kind of chickens, you know, the ones that don't like it very much.
Yeah. Feisty kind.
Well, he knew a hell of a lot about dogs, and he knew a lot about genetics and breeding. And he was one of those sort of guys you just sit to and listen for. You could listen to him for days just on you know, how to breed good dogs and how to get the best out of them. Anyway, you know, we went out and we hunted some critters in various places in the southern part of the US through the contacts that I gained over there. And most of these guys aren't on the internet or on Facebook. They're probably just too old. But they definitely sparked my interest in, especially in regards to your coonhounds and a lot of the breeds that you know, yeah, like your dry ground hunting dogs, your cold nosed dogs that hunt down in the New Mexico and in Texas and places like that.
Yes, sir.
And you know, a few guys in Utah. There's you know the number of houndsmen over there and the different packs of hounds is amazing compared to what we have here. We don't have a particularly robust registry of hounds here, and we're working on improving that. There's a number of people that are improving things here, but there are a lot of obstacles in the way that we need to work around and work over.
You are very well traveled in the United States. Holy moly, you covered some ground. You don't even live in the United States, and you've covered more ground than me.
I've been around for a lot of years too. But, it's my interest. I was fortunate enough to be able to get over there with work initially, and then subsequently my interest in hunting and the contacts that I made over there, who will remain lifelong friends, have helped me a lot with my passion with the hounds and with the dogs. I'm lucky enough to have some fairly handy Yark Terriers that I've imported from Europe. And I send a lot of the genetic material from here over to the US. Those terriers are getting very, very popular amongst guys that hunt with hounds and terriers.
Especially they are so intense. Oh my goodness!
Yeah, they are fairly intense. But it's like with any dog. Pardon me. You know, just because a dog happens to be a certain breed, it doesn't mean he's a good one. And it's up to the breeders and up to the hunters to maintain that high standard of breeding. And you, without getting too gushy over what happens in the US, you guys breed some damn good dogs and performance animals, and your track record proves it. You know, especially when it comes to hounds and those chickens and those other dogs I was talking about.
You know, it's funny. Another Australian had told me that that's very similar thing, and I just got all red in the face. I was like, oh, but you know, we just have so much. First of all, I have so many questions. It's hard for me. I have a hard time when I'm talking to people like you of not just going like full bore in the questioning because I just get so excited. But where were you in New Mexico, if you don't mind I ask?
I'm trying to. Look, I've just got to be a bit careful about where I say we were. We travelled with work. We travelled down to Texas and trained with some of the Texas Ranger dudes, and we were lucky enough to be able to get a couple of contacts down in. I've got to be a bit careful about where I say we were, because a lot of these guys get fairly
fair enough. I agree.
I get fairly touchy about
sure. I guess I was just gonna. You could just say forest or desert. That puts you in a 2,000 kilometer difference.
it is right down the bottom in desert country.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay. So that's my stomping grounds. The south end is my stomping grounds. I know the whole state really, really well, but I live real close to a dry ground mountain lion hunter, and he is the real deal. He's very public, so I don't mind. His name is Brett Vaughn. He's been a guest on the show, and he has the Born 100 Years Too Late YouTube channel, but man, he's a cool guy.
I'm a big fan of that guy. He's the real thing. He's a real cowboy.
Oh, he is the real everything. He's awesome. He only lives 15 minutes away from me, actually.
That's fantastic. I'm right into the sort of thing that he's doing, and especially with the mules and going out into the country with the mules and his hounds. It's that's really something, I reckon.
Oh, if I wasn't into sighthounds, that's what I'm doing next. I'm absolutely going to be astride a mule following my pack through the desert. Because we have, I mean, just where me and Brett live, literally like the city limit ends of the city we live in, and then it's 9.4 million acres of public land. So, and it's full of deer and mountain lions and all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, we're so lucky and fortunate to have that around us to hunt in anytime we want for free.
That's fantastic. And look, to a large degree, where I live is very similar to that. I live on the outskirts of Melbourne, about an hour east of the, you know, one of Australia's largest cities. And my farm backs onto to National Park, and we're not far from State Forest that contains large numbers of Samba deer. And we're lucky enough to be able to, you know, we've got a 7 month season. We can pack our hounds in, and we can go hunting pretty well any time we like, which is something that it's becoming rarer and rarer, and it's constantly under threat as well. They're trying to shut up a lot of that country, so we can't go and hunt in it. So.
What's the rationale behind that? I don't even understand why anyone would want to stop that. Like, what is their rationale, if you don't mind I ask?
Well, look, I think it's a multifaceted attack, I suppose. And it's not an attack in the true meaning of the word, an attack. It's a situation where there's people that feel that it's important for them to have a great forest national park or parks that are similar to that, where nobody can go in and do the things that have traditionally happened there since white man was here in Australia. They want to cut that area off, or they want to limit access to that area because they think that it's better for everybody involved. It just it doesn't stand up to good science.
Not at all. It doesn't that's my job.
Exactly, and it doesn't stand up to good land management either. You know, the deer are overabundant. The government is spending millions of dollars trying to work out effective ways of managing the deer by themselves. And that's proved to be a dismal failure. And they know full well that the most efficient and effective way to deal with large numbers of Samba deer is to use, you know, good hound crews to be able to manage them.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious to answer too. I mean, why would you be spending taxpayer dollars when people would be willing to pay to go out and hunt? That's the crux of the North American wildlife management system, and it's worked very well. But I just don't understand, especially in a place like Australia, how anyone could be opposed to hunting these non-native animals that are so abundant and obviously so destructive.
Well, you and me both. You know, it's a bit of a no-brainer, really. But it seems that there are those within the bureaucracies who have got a hell of a lot more push than we have.
Sure.
When it comes to how things should look and how things should be done. But sooner or later, the truth has got a habit of coming to the surface. And once all this stuff is distilled down to its lowest common denominator, I think somebody somewhere along the line will say, yeah, look, these guys are pretty well the best thing that we've got. Every week you hear about deer being splattered in our cities, or, you know, running through people's yards, causing problems and things. And these aren't deer like the deer that you have over there. You know, they're significantly bigger than whitetail. They're nearly as big as an elk.
They're like 500 kilos, huh? I think Corbin said they're like 400 to 500 kilos, something like that.
It'd be a fairly big one at 400 kilos, but, you know, a big stag, he'll tip 350 kilos, which is that's a fair bit of venison. You know,
you don't want to hit that with your car.
That's an 800-pound animal. You don't need to hit a big one to destroy a cow. We see plenty of cows that are smashed by, you know, 150-kilo animals.
I was on a date once with this girl. And we were driving down this road going a little over the speed limit. I don't want to say that in front of a cop, but I'm just kidding. But we were going a little too fast in her Nissan 350Z. We hit a jackrabbit and her entire bumper came off, and we ran it over. So, like, you don't need to hit a big animal to do a lot of damage to a car, I guess.
You guys have got some weapons-grade jackrabbits over there, right?
That's why you were saying we have the best dogs in the world, because I'm chasing weapons-grade jackrabbits. I'm taking that from you, by the way.
It's cool. Yeah, look, you know, with the hunting here, the culture of hunting here, it'll never die. You know, there's young guys that are coming through all the time that are, you know, keen to maintain what we've done forever, and it's improving all the time. The techniques and the tactics, the equipment, all the good Garmin electronic stuff that's out there.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's helping. You know, access to areas that we couldn't get to in the past, as far as vehicles are concerned, as far as recovery equipment's concerned, that's all improved. I can remember a time when we were young guys, we were hard pressed to get a four-wheel drive vehicle.
Yeah,
and we had to go into some fairly hard country just with, you know, pick what you guys call pickup trucks. We call them utes here, with limited slip diffs and, you know, snow tires on the back and turf or hand winches, just to get into areas where we can hunt deer or hunt sambar.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to a man I frequently talk to, obviously, a lot of people, but he's in his 80s. He's been hunting coyotes with sighthounds for decades, and rabbits and hares. And he said when he started, he had like an old Isuzu car, and they like bashed out the back window, and that's what they would release dogs out of. They were like going across pasture, and this is in like the 50s. They're going across pasture in a car. I'm like, that's so crazy. I mean, I love like ingenuity, making do with what you got. I love that. But there's a limit. And I feel like going across the desert in a car is that limit. But you got to do what you got to do, I guess.
You make me feel bad. I can remember doing exactly that. You know, we used to call them, we'd call those cars paddock bombs, you know, the vehicles that were ready to retire. And I think some of the best race drivers in the world learned to drive in paddock bombs, you know.
Paddock bombs, that's a great name.
Yeah. The guy that introduced me to sighthounds was an old, he was actually a retired policeman, and he kept bloodhounds for tracking men back in the day. And in the 70s, when I was a young guy, he introduced me to running dogs, and he had beautiful Scottish deerhounds, the real thing, you know, not these things that you see in the show rings in Australia these days.
Yeah, yeah.
And his name was Doug Mummery. He was a legendary hunter and a legendary houndsman. He introduced so many fantastic dogs into Australia, you know. A lot of the foxhounds, a lot of the bloodhounds, the Scottish deerhounds, the Irish wolfhounds. Him and a handful of other guys were probably the genesis of a lot of the running dogs that we actually see here today in Australia.
Wow, that's amazing.
And he drove around in paddock bombs chasing kangaroos and things like that back in the day.
When did kangaroo hunting become illegal with dogs, or period? I guess the way I understand it is it depends on the state, but it's legal in some states and not in others.
Well, as far as I know, the only place that you can legally hunt macropods, which are kangaroos and wallabies,
yes sir,
in Australia is Tasmania, and they still do it today. They hunt them with scent hounds and, you know, flush them out and to waiting shotgunners.
Mm-hmm.
And they shoot their little their wallabies and kangaroos and mince them up and make patties out of them. They love them.
So why does Tasmania have macropod hunting and the mainland in Australia doesn't? I've always kind of wondered that. I was wondering maybe you knew the history of that.
Well, you're a man of science, I understand. The large vertebrate, native vertebrate predators in Tasmania, you know, for instance, the Tasmanian tiger was the animal probably most responsible for managing the herbivores back in the day. And when it became extinct, the foxes had never spread really in Tasmania. The introduced foxes never really taken off in Tasmania, even though there'd been a few attempts to try to start them in there. The wallabies, or the small tamar wallabies, became very much overabundant, and they became a problem as far as management of pasture and all that sort of stuff was concerned. Gotcha. And also having a disproportionately large or adverse effect on the country as far as overgrazing, etc. Mm-hmm. So the locals started hunting them with hounds, you know. Not just hunting with hounds, but it's very popular down there hunting with hounds. A lot of the guys shoot them at night. Unfortunately, they can't keep up with the large numbers, and they're still subject to being poisoned by 1080 poison and all that sort of stuff as well.
Wow. That's why I love talking to people from other places in the world. Like, you would never think that wallabies would be something that you have to poison because there's too many of them. It just seems like, it's just weird. But I mean, I think everyone in the world would prefer using weapons and hounds than poison, I think. And I know it's unfortunately for large scale agricultural industry, it's commonplace because it's an effective way to mass control a population, but that's a huge bit of ammunition in the belts of sportsmen worldwide, is that, look, there are few alternatives to population management. Let us pay, you know, our money goes back into preserving wildlife populations and protecting the habitat that everyone enjoys, even non-hunters. And also we can avoid poisoning or mass scale aerial gunning and mass scale culling. You know, the wildlife has an intrinsic value. It has a cultural value. It has a food value. And it also allows people to go out and enjoy our public land, or in your case, I don't know what you'd call Australian public land, but that.
Well, it's exactly what it is. It's public land. They call it various things, but including crown land and all that sort of stuff. But ultimately, it is public land, and it should be open for all of the public, including hunters and houndsmen, to be used in the way it's always been used traditionally. Getting back to the kangaroo thing, it was in many places it was legal to hunt kangaroos using coursing dogs up until about the early 70s, and then various pieces of legislation were brought into place due to, inverted commas, what do they call it, community expectations. I don't know which community they were expecting, but they banned a lot of that stuff, and unfortunately, along with that ban went some of the most magnificent sight hounds you'd ever see.
Yeah, that's a real shame, because there's not really, I mean, I can't, what else is there comparable of running ability of that size in Australia to hunt? Is there anything? Because I know foxes they're small. I mean, they're not going to be, you don't need a large, powerful coursing hound to catch them. Is there anything comparable to a kangaroo in running ability?
Well, not really. The eastern grey kangaroos, red kangaroos, they're unique. You know, there's not much out anywhere else in the world that compares to them. As far as animals that can put up that provide good, as far as good game animals concerned. Mm-hmm. We're allowed to kill them under permit, and the pet industry uses their meat, and the human consumption industry uses their meat, but you just can't hunt them with dogs.
That's a shame. That's ridiculous. If you can hunt them, that's a shame.
Anyway, I think that's a chapter that's closed in the history of Australia. The mainstream media seem to put paid to a lot of that sort of stuff, and that's the end of it. But look, foxes even, the guys that are out there on the weekends chasing foxes with hounds and terriers and running dogs, they do it for the love of hunting, just like the rest of us do. The fox industry, or the fur industry in Australia, pretty well collapsed towards the end of the 80s. Because of the pressure that was being put on by the animal rights people. There's no foxes kept in captivity in Australia for the fur industry. The only foxes that were taken were the foxes out of the wild, which posed a direct threat to our highly endangered native wildlife.
Yeah, sounds like a win on all levels. Yeah.
because of the fur industry, people stopped taking fox. You know, I remember as a kid, you know, you'd get $30 or $35 for a good fox skin, and that was big money.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
You know, and I'm talking in the 80s, and you know, it was fantastic. A lot of guys paid for their hunting and their fuel and their, you know, vehicles just through hunting foxes. And when the fur industry collapsed, in effect, here in Australia, that all went by the wayside. And unfortunately, it never really caught up. You know, the guys that hunt foxes recreationally now, they get a bounty. I think they get, you know, $10 a fox skin. But in real terms, it doesn't really, mm-hmm. it doesn't compare. If they were to have a, you know, a good fur industry back up and running, you know, and target cats and foxes here in Australia, and actively encourage it, you'd find that these introduced predators would their numbers would drop down very, very quickly.
That's exactly what I've said for feral pigs. You know, if there was a market on them, that they were actually marketable, it's working on it. There is a small pet food industry, even a small human consumption industry, that you can take live wild hogs to USDA inspected facilities. But I always joked that if like wild pig meat ever became like really fancy fine dining and they were worth a ton of money, they'd be gone in a year. You know what I mean? There would be guys out there with thermal scopes smoking 50 a night. But I mean, that's the thing. It's kind of a weird catch 22, because, you know, the more valuable those foxes became, I'm sure the harder it was to find them. But, you know, at the same time, the goal in Australia is to get rid of them. I mean, there's just no ifs, ands, or buts. I guess nobody wants to see them fully eradicated because they love hunting them. But I don't think anyone would be upset if their numbers were reduced significantly to allow, you know, your critically endangered animals a chance to get their populations back up and running.
Look, I agree 100%. Look, again, hearkening back to your training as a scientist, that I don't think that there's a case anywhere in the world where complete eradication has been achieved.
That's right. It's basically impossible.
Species, you know? So to eradicate foxes and feral cats and similar creatures here in Australia, it's not going to happen anytime soon. And that all we can really hope to do is to try to manage the numbers and you know, try to avoid a catastrophic loss of native wildlife. You know, and it's getting harder and harder all the time. These governments are trying to you know, they're actively discouraging hunting, you know, especially using dogs. You know?
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, it's hard to say because it's always hindsight when you look back at these things. But are there hound hunting groups in Australia that are still actively lobbying right now just to kind of keep things going? Because like in America, we have our state hound organizations. We have like other just hound organizations that are across state lines and that a ton of people are, you know, working with. But I think a unified front is key. And that's kind of what we want to be here at Houndsman XP, is a way that we can all band together under this one banner, and we can have a lot of strength worldwide standing together and get organized. Is there anything you guys are, is there, like, for instance, is there any issues right now that houndsmen are kind of rallying around to keep from losing any rights right now? Or is it kind of right now things kind of in stasis? What do you think?
Look, there's a number of hound hunting and dog hunting organizations in Australia. And some of them are really, really good, but the vast majority in real terms aren't particularly effective for the exact reason you just mentioned. You know, they're not, there's no coordinated strategic planning to get these organizations singing from the same hymn book. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still all the, you know, the backbiting and the, you know, people in the wrong camp, you know, talking and not agreeing with each other on lots of things. So even hunters, as a general proposition, you know, the duck hunters need to understand that they need to support the houndsmen, and the houndsmen need to understand that they need to support the duck hunters and the deer stalkers and the rabbit shooters. we're very, very much still divided. You know, there's plenty that will say that we're not, but the truth of the matter is we haven't got it all in one sock.
I mean, I could say the exact same thing, and that's exactly what we're working towards. And I've kind of dedicated my life as a sportsman to is trying to build those bridges better between all our communities, because that's the way we're going to win and move forward. Because like you were saying earlier, and I completely agree, our foes are incredibly well-funded and organized, and we need to be the exact same.
Well, we're dragging the chain a bit, but you guys and a lot of the guys in the UK and various other places are slowly getting there. Here in Australia, we're trying as well, but we're not in the business, I suppose, of reinventing the wheel. If you guys are doing something really well and it's working for you, we're going to copy it. Don't worry about that. We need to do it on the understanding that you guys understand why we're doing it. We do have a lot to learn, and we've got a hell of a long way to go, but we're getting there. And we're staving off the antis. But the thing is, I think complacency and apathy seem to be probably our worst enemies.
I totally agree with that. And hiding is a big one. People feel that if you just don't ever show yourself, you'll never be a target. And I just couldn't disagree more, because when that law says all hunting with dogs is banished now, it didn't matter if you were hunting with terriers for field rats in an alfalfa field in the middle of New Mexico. It's now illegal. It didn't matter if you were a target or not. Now you can't do it legally anymore. And so hiding, to me, it also seems like a subconscious admission of guilt to an anti-hunter. They'd be like, see, like, why were you not, like, why are you hiding? To me, getting out and being honest, non-emotive, where you are being a good steward and also someone who can logically and cogently defend your argument against someone who has a purely emotional attack against you, is going to be our best way forward. And always being an ambassador when you can. You don't have to be Mr. Charisma, but always bring up hounds in the most positive light and invite people to come out and see your dogs, come out and see you hunt. They don't have to come to your house, but if you have hunting friends or anybody, just be like, yeah, why don't you come out and see my terriers while we dig? Or why don't you come see my dogs chase this hare? Like, I guarantee they'll have a good time. That's how I feel. That's been my style. And I think it's the best way forward for us, in my opinion.
You've got a very, very good attitude. And I think if that attitude could spread throughout the hound hunting community, we would do a hell of a lot better than we're doing now. But you're 100% right. The burying your head in the sand, hoping that it's all going to go away, is no way to go. And that hiding business, it's never worked. it's never worked in the past, and it won't work now. Probably one of our worst enemies, I suppose, is the mainstream media here. They look for opportunities to put up a story that's going to be emotive and that's going to get people to watch TVs and buy newspapers.
Clickbait. Yep.
Exactly. And, every year we see it with the duck hunters. You're still there?
Hello? Yeah, I'm here. I got you.
Yeah. Every year we see it with the duck hunting, this year they'd got to the stage where they'd actually limited the bag limit, the daily bag limit, down to 3 ducks, So who wants to drive 60 or 70 miles to a duck swamp to shoot 3 ducks, turn around and come home,
That's, yeah, wow.
And they base a lot of this stuff on so-called science or on estimates made by employees of various game management authorities. When you actually look at the truth of the matter, there's a fair bit of a gap. And, we've got to be prepared to take some of these guys on. Not everything that these government organisations tell us is 100% the truth. And we're learning that more and more every day with this COVID-19 thing. We need we need to be objective, and we need to question some of these things that come up.
You know, I don't know what the situation is in Australia, but in America, all game agencies work for the public, and almost all their data is available to the public. And although I don't work for the game and fish department, I have lots of friends that do, and I can say soundly that almost everyone I know that works in the game department is very pro hunting, and they're more than happy to talk about hunting and talk about legislation and help us get organized. I think all it takes is just the tiniest effort to get involved, and you can make a difference. And, you know, people are like, I don't go to the game conference meetings because they're just a waste of time. They already have their agenda and they don't want to make up their mind. Well, maybe, but if you were active 2 years ago, you may not even have to be at this meeting to begin with. And I just think everyone is such a keyboard warrior and nobody wants to get involved anymore. And I just feel like, yeah, it's not that hard to get involved to protect our lifestyle. And that's all we need to do, really.
Well, yeah, look, you're right. Look, it would be fantastic to have a game management authority here in Australia, or in Victoria in particular, that actively promoted hunting. They don't. They don't actively, unfortunately. They're an enforcement agency. They say that they're a training agency, and they produce these documents from time to time, many of which are of questionable quality and legality sometimes. But look, you know, we're happy to help wherever we can as hunters are concerned. But it needs to be a two-way street. You know, if you've got a game management authority, they should be promoting hunting. They should be promoting, active recovery of hounds and educating the public. You know, if you see a hound wandering down a road, you know, it's not a savage, nasty dog. It's got a tracking collar on it. It's got a name and a telephone number and all that sort of stuff on it. These are the sort of things that a lot of these game management authorities need to consider when they say that they're helping us hunters. You know, it's not lip service isn't enough.
Yes, sir.
You need to be able to back it up with some positive action from both sides of the fence. You know,
totally agree. Yeah, I am very lucky. I live in an area of the world that hunting is a really deep and important part of the culture, and for the most part, widely accepted as just a fabric of the community of the Western United States. And so a lot of the elected officials and people I actively vote for are very pro hunting and pro public land. And like I said, I mean, I know many people in the game department and they're all super pro hunting. I'm not saying everyone is, and I'm not saying it's perfect. Nobody is. I mean, you don't even agree with your own wife 100% of the time. I'm all looking over my shoulder as I say that. But like, I think overall, yeah, like you were saying earlier, I think we do have an easier battle here in the United States, and I do feel for you. That's why I was so excited to talk to you, because you've been a frontline soldier in it for a long time, and I just wanted to hear what you had to say about it.
Well, as I say, I'm not going to quit pushing the agendas of hunting with hounds and hunting with dogs. I'm going to do it, you know, as long as I can. And there are others that are probably doing the same thing. We just need to be able to get it together where we're singing off the same hymn book here in Australia in particular. But as I said earlier, we definitely need to learn more from you guys. And our hunting authorities and our hunting agencies could probably do well to learn a lot from your what you guys are doing over in the US, you know?
I think it's a cultural thing that takes a long time too. That's the thing. Culture moves slowly. I mean, it doesn't seem like it, but it does. And I just think it's so strange that a game management organization would not be like pro hunting and outdoor usage. That just seems so strange to me. Yeah.
Look, they say in a lot of cases, yes, of course they're pro hunting, etc. But the thing is, they don't actively seek to promote hunting.
Right, right. It's one thing to say, but to actually give concrete substance, that's a whole nother thing entirely.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, they're there to remind you what the regulations say. They're there to remind you of what's legal and what's not legal. Mm-hmm. They're there to issue infringement notices and things like that to guys that may have done the wrong thing. But at the same time, they're not really managing game. They're managing hunters, which there's a big difference.
Yes, sir. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I actually, years ago, sat on the state government hunting advisory committee, which was, I suppose, to a large degree, the precursor to the Game Management Authority here. And the model that we put up was one that would actually, that would engage or have an organisation that would engage hunters and engage the public and do what pretty well what your guys in the US are doing. But it seems that that morphed into something else, and it's probably not what we would like to see now. You know? Mm-hmm.
I always ask this to all my guests, and I'm going to ask you the same. What is your favorite animal to hunt with dogs, and why?
Geez, it's like asking a guy, you know, which is your favorite child, you know. But, look, I love hunting Sambar deer with hounds, purely because it's a challenge. You know, it's not the sort of thing where there's a guaranteed outcome. You know, you need to have it all together. You need to have good dogs. You need to be able to, find the quarry, hunt it, and come up with a result at the end of the day. And just being out there, in my view, hunting Sambar is enough for me. I've shot my fair share of Sambar. If I don't shoot another one for the rest of my life, I probably shot more than most people will ever see in their life. But just being out there listening to the hounds and being part of the deal up in the mountains is enough for me.
Oh, man. You're just – I'm grinning right now because, I mean, to me, it's all the same feelings, just in a different way. You know, I mean, the sighthounds don't make sound, but they sure do put on a heck of a show for you.
Oh, they provide good company, and that's it. They, you know, they what do they say? It's a ringside seat to the best show on earth, if you're a houndsman.
Yes, sir. When you were running sighthounds, were you running primarily for foxes because of the pelt prices were real good?
Yeah, I had terriers to flush the foxes from cover. And the running dogs to clean them up once they hit that open country. You know, and we hunted a lot of cropping area, you know, wheat and barley areas, in around Billabongs, an Oxbow Lake, guys would call it an Oxbow Lake, in around Billabongs in lignum country, which is like a heavy ground cover. And those sighthounds, they'd kill a fox quicker than you could kill it with a .22-250.
Oh man, that sounds so fun. That looks fun. I would love to come try that. You know, did you guys have hares back then? I'm just going to ask because I'm a hare dork. But
we have a lot of European hares here in Australia in another thing that I do through the wildlife control business. We actually manage hares where they're overabundant in certain areas, and we've got lots of hares here. And as a young guy, we would go and chase hares with our running dogs, and you needed to have a pretty good one that would catch it one out. And I reckon in my whole life, I could probably count on one hand how many dogs I've seen catch a hare by themselves on a flat run. There's not many.
Yeah, my dogs, I mean, I actually, my season has started off unbelievable. And my first time ever, my female ran her first hare down by herself, and I was just on cloud nine. She has been impressing me so much. The last six times we've gone out, which includes a little bit of the tail end of last season, her skill has just improved every time. And I went out on Wednesday, and we were walking, and my male, he's like glue to me. He just walks right beside me. And my pup was out with my female, and she was kind of out sniffing around. She's got a great nose on her, so she was sniffing for the hares. And one got up about 60 yards away, and it was just over a rise where my male couldn't see. And my female and my pup tear off after it. And in my mind, I'm going, dang it, like, you know, she's off by herself. I was trying to get my male to join the course, but he didn't see it. And she takes off running, and she's been coursing him for about a minute. And I start seeing her put turns on him. And I was like, oh, man, like, she may win. And so I'm watching. And then finally, you know, she runs real tight with the hare, and she won't be shaken. You know how greyhounds typically overshoot their quarry real bad? She doesn't. She just keeps this real high speed agility on the back of the hare. And And at about the minute and 40 second mark, she really started panicking the hare, and it was starting to make those like frantic micro turns where it couldn't figure out where to go. And then she tackled it. And I'll tell you right now, Alex, I probably jumped 10,000 feet in the air when she made that catch. I couldn't believe it. I just remember I just took off running and cheering in the direction. And it was amazing. I have a picture of it. I sent you some pictures of my hounds running recently. That was on Thursday morning. But yeah, it was amazing. And that's the first time I've ever seen a dog catch a hare alone. And I'm pretty proud of it.
Oh, well, you've definitely got a good dog. And I think that was the benchmark back in the day. If you had a dog that could catch a hare on a flat run by itself, you had a good dog. And you sound like you've got a good one.
Yeah, both of them have really impressed the heck out of me. My dogs are dedicated hare specialists, and I've turned them loose on 15 and I've caught 13 this season. Or I'm sorry, the tail end of last season and this season. So I'm on cloud nine with my hounds right now. They're doing great. I'm so proud of them.
That's excellent. I get a few flashbacks of the old days when I look at the photographs of your running dogs. They certainly remind me of things that happened back when I was a young guy.
You know, it's funny. I never would have considered taking a camera out in the field. It's kind of a lot to carry, especially when I'm on foot. I have my binoculars on my chest, and then I have that big bulky camera, and I have my female on slip lead. You know, it's a lot going on, but I just cherish those pictures. And when I'm fortunate enough to be on private land where I can use my buggy cross pasture, I get way better pictures and it's a lot more fun. But I was on public land those days, and so I was just walking, and all I do is have my camera pre-focused on a distance about 50 meters away. And then as soon as, because you know, those dogs can get from 0 to 50 meters away from you in like 2 seconds, if that.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have it ready. So when the hare comes up, it always surprises the heck out of you. And I just throw the camera up and just start blazing away while I'm cheering to them. And I get pictures until they're my zoom. I'm using a Nikon D3200 with an action lens that can zoom out to 300 millimeter. And I'm able to, yeah. It takes really good action shots. And those photos I sent you yesterday, those were at about 200 meters. So it's got amazing zoom.
That's excellent. Look, you call them Nikons, I call them Nikons here. And I've got a few Nikon cameras, and I'm a big fan of that body. I run a few different lenses on mine. But I don't get out and use it as much as I'd like to, especially for the action stuff.
Yeah, it's I want to show you, now that I know you're into cameras, I'll send you some photos afterwards. I've posted some to our Patreon page, and I've posted some on the Houndsman XP podcast group, but I'll send you some other ones too. But I take them from the speeding buggy, and I want to show you some of the photos I've gotten. Those photos are why I'm talking to you right now, because Chris saw some of the photos I had posted in a Facebook page and then like lurked on my page and was like, I want to talk to this guy about his crazy dogs. And so here I am.
I'm a lover of anywhere where there's performance dogs involved as far as hunting is concerned.
Cause me too.
That's the true measure. That's the ultimate goal. It's the real McCoy. You know, you hear the show people talk about, oh, look, this dog needs to look like that. It needs to have feet this shape, and it needs to have a body that shape, you know, because it can do this, this, and this. But at the end of the day, the truth is out there when you're in the field. You find out who's who in the zoo. As you guys say, the bullshit stops when the tailgate drops, and it's nothing could be truer when it comes to talking about hounds.
You know, it's funny. I know a guy, a good friend of mine, who courses, and when he was young, this was in the early 80s, there was an AKC greyhound meet and in eastern New Mexico out on the big prairies. And all these AKC show folks brought out their greyhounds to go out and course jackrabbits, hares. And my buddy said that he saw 40 dogs released on one jackrabbit and they couldn't get it caught. And all those show people were upset because they're like, they're bred to catch jackrabbits. They're bred to catch jackrabbits. Like, why can't they catch them? And my buddy and his father brought their like coursing long dogs. They're just, you know, performance bred for eons. and they caught four hares with three dogs in one day. And I was like, those other people were blue in the face, he said, because they're so mad that their duck, they released 40 dogs on one rabbit. And my buddy said he was laughing so hard watching 40 dogs chase one rabbit until it just effortlessly outran them all.
I was laughing. I agree 100%. I was laughing at I attended a show when I first brought these Yark Terriers into Australia. I attended a show to see what the terrier people were doing with their terriers, you know. And, it was quite funny. Most of them were ladies, middle-aged to slightly older ladies that were showing these dogs. And they were telling me, espousing the virtues and the hunting skills of all their various terriers, you know. And I could tell full well that these things had never seen a critter in their life, you know.
Yeah.
And it had never done any of that terrier stuff. And you think to yourself,
I wonder what their faces would be like when they see their terrier doing terrier stuff. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's right. Everybody's a terrier person until they see their terrier doing terrier stuff. And then they think, oh, God, what have I got here? And, I've got some fantastic stories about terriers. But I was lucky enough to get over to, because of my Serbian heritage, I get over to Europe whenever I can, and I buy dogs and bring over dogs and frozen semen to bring to Australia, and I look at those guys over there, and you know they attend dog shows, but none of their dogs are non-working types. You know, the average, I think the average wage of a guy over there is about $300 a month or less, which isn't very much money, and the dogs that these guys have got. If anybody's got a dog tied up in the yard or in a pen in the yard, it's a good one because they can't afford to feed ordinary ones. some of these competition dogs and hunting dogs that they breed there are just absolutely outstanding, and they're doing what they were bred to do by the Germans back at the turn of last century. That they can't really test them in Germany anymore, but the good old boys in Serbia aren't particularly concerned about the rules around the place, so they still test their dogs in all disciplines, and that's why the dogs that come out of there are pretty well the best in the world, you know, because that's what they're used. And to support your story about your friend's long dogs catching those hares, you know, unless they're tested, unless they're used and they're trained to do that stuff, you're going to lose it in a generation.
Oh, yeah.
Even less.
I thought it was real funny. The first time I ever saw a Yog Terrier, a Jag Terrier, was for hunting pigs. And I was like, what? When my buddy, he brought them up. They weren't his dogs. They were his buddy's dogs who hunt pigs. And when he let those dogs out, I was like, these dogs hunt pigs? And he was like, these dogs are some of the best hunting dogs in the world. He's like, don't let their size fool you. They think they weigh 100 pounds. And he's like, they got a great nose on them too. And I was like, I got to see this to believe it. And I didn't get to go hunting with him that day, but I mean, he's showing me tons of pictures, and he's just got a pack of those little dudes that catch pigs, and they don't catch them, but they track them and then bay them up, and they think they want to try to catch them, but they're little dudes, but man, they're pretty intense little dogs. I've learned a lot about terriers in general, mostly from just talking to everybody. I still have never seen good terrier work, and that's something I would really like to do in my life. I need to travel more. And now that I work for this podcast, I really hope I get more opportunities to go around and see other people doing some really good terrier work, because I think it's really cool and really interesting.
Well, make sure you tell me when you do, because there are some outstanding Yag Terriers in the U.S. I've got some good friends down in Texas, which isn't that far from you, I suppose.
Yeah, not too far, just like 10 hours.
Well, in Australia, that's not that far.
Yeah, it's not that far here either.
It's nothing for us to drive 4 or 5 hours just to go for a hunt for a weekend, you know. So.
Oh yeah, same here. But,
there are some very very well bred terriers over in the US, or Yark Terriers, and there's lion hunters that use them and bear hunters that use them, and you know they've got some pretty good genetics over there. And these are the sort of guys that'll make sure that the what those dogs are supposed to perform like, they continue to perform in that way, you know.
That's incredible. And, They're so feisty.
Yeah, yeah, they're good. But they're good, manageable dog too. You know, well-bred ones are...
Oh, sure, sure. Good. To people, they're no wonderful. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No different to your dogs or scent hounds. You know, the breed really is... it's not as important as the family and the bloodlines that the dogs come from. People seem to think just because a dog happens to be a particular breed that it's going to be able to do all this stuff. It's nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I got a half English bird dog, half pit bull from unknown ancestry. I just got it from the pound. Seriously, one of the best hunting dogs I've had. So versatile, trainable, intelligent. And I mean, sometimes it comes down to just the individuals themselves, but I agree with you that it's that type more and that breeding type more than anything. Because these long dogs in the United States here, man, they've been bred all over the place. Like all kinds of different sighthound breeds are in the lineages, especially staghounds, the like North American coyote hunting sighthound. Those dogs have deerhound, wolfhound, greyhound, saluki, borzoi, even shepherd or heeler cattle dog in them and stuff, all kinds of stuff in them. But like you said, when the tailgate drops, I want to see what you got. And only the best and the best are being bred for centuries in the United States. And that's where we've gotten today to this, the staghound, basically. And yeah.
That's how we all wound up with our specialist, so-called specialist breeds, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Look, I've seen a lot of game bred pit bulls in the US, and I've yet to see one that's man aggressive or mean. I'm talking about a real game bred pit bull, not some of the traps that you see around the place.
Sure, sure. And
when you talk to some of those good old boys that had those dogs back in the day, it was amazing to see some of these dogs, and you know, zero human aggression, and they were just magnificent dogs. And the way in which they raised them and they bred them, it was something to behold. Unfortunately, when breeds like that get into the hands of people that don't know what they're doing, that's when you start getting issues.
You know, it was talking about the specialists too. I think the versatile gun dog breeds are really cool, how they can do a lot of, they're expected to do so many different tasks. But I also think the specialists are super interesting. And I'm trying to say that from the most unbiased position, because what I'm running are true specialists all the way to the core. I mean, there is no running prey more difficult to catch than a jackrabbit, aside an American pronghorn, which are not legal to be pursued with dogs. So, I mean, a hare is the toughest game. So you got to have a dog that's bred only for its running ability, faster, farther, and with more agility. And so it is amazing to see the variation even in sighthounds. And I do like to, and I do enjoy seeing these specialist dogs. I think it's really cool. I just think that what you can turn a wolf into is fascinating, because a harrier, my dogs, these like mutated speed wolves laying on my couch, a harrier, a terrier, and a bulldog can all mate with each other. They're all the same species, and yet they can do all these incredibly different specialized tasks. I can't get enough of it, and I geek over it constantly.
and sometimes they do all mate with each other, and you get all these weird things you see around the place.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about running dogs or sighthounds, you know as well as I do that they're probably the oldest real hunting dog lineage that us humans are, you know, had the pleasure to hunt with. When you go back, even back to, you know, prior to the pyramids, there's
oh yeah, Saluki's there.
Depictions of sighthounds, which predates Christianity. You know, you're starting to talk about some pretty compelling evidence that humans and dogs have been had a good relationship for a long time.
You know, I think it's really. I mean, I don't want to. Because sighthounds are so old, the practice of hunting with sighthounds, I don't know how to say it. I guess I'm just going to, but I think sighthounds are kind of one of the most complete hunting dogs, because they had to do it all for primitive man who had no weapons except for spears and arrows. So it's like a good sighthound will find the quarry, pursue the quarry, kill the quarry, retrieve the quarry, repeat. You know, they don't really need any human assistance to do it. All they need is you to take them to the right place, and they can do it all on their own, which I do find amazing. They're like a combination of a tracking hound and a weapon. And I just think that's so cool.
Well, I suppose the term sighthound to a degree would be a bit of a misnomer in that, you know, even though they're primarily bred to react to movement and, you know, sight, these things have still got a pretty good nose. You know, they've got better noses than we have.
Yeah, I mean, so my Jip can find them hidden in the grass like a dang bird dog. She's so good at it.
Well, their olfactory systems are pretty good. And, you know, when you compare a sighthound to a nosehound, well, you know, there are differences there.
Of course.
But they're all bred selectively for different purposes. If you look at the genotypes and the phenotypes in particular of most of the hounds, us humans, thanks to, I suppose, Dr. Mendelsohn and all of those people, have been able to identify the genes that we're looking for and isolating those genes in order to get what we're looking for. And those sighthounds, I suppose unwittingly a lot of us have done it, or a lot of breeders have done it in the past, but if you look at the science behind it, it is definitely incredible.
Yeah. And I didn't want to say that sighthounds are this perfect hunting dog. Obviously, they have their limitations. They're not. There's a reason that coon hunters aren't using greyhounds to find coons. You know what I mean? I'm just saying, as far as like, if I had to take any dog into the apocalypse, I would take a pack of good Salukis with me, because they are going to be the ones that put the most food on my table with no weapons. Like, if I have to hunt with a stick, like, I need something that can do it all for me. You know what I mean?
I agree with it 100%.
So yeah, I don't know. That's just tangential thinking. Every time I walk in the desert, I exercise my hounds in the desert with me every day. And I just think like, man, if everything went up in flames and I had to flee into the desert, I would do pretty good, because I could still survive out there. And also, you could take these dogs and just put them on slip lead and cruise around until you jump a mule deer and send the dogs to them. And they could catch that deer, hold him, and kill him before you get there. You know, I just think they're a pretty incredible old school. I always feel like some kind of Paleolithic man when I'm out there with them. I just feel like so ancient, you know, and I'm just cruising around, except I have a camera and I'm wearing tennis shoes and I have a cell phone, you know, other than that. Yeah.
I think secretly most hunters, you get a lot of time to think about stuff when you're out in those mountains with dogs or chasing, you know, critters across the flat country. And you often think back and wonder what the first guy was thinking, the first guy that ever saw a dog do that, you know. And it's amazing, isn't it?
Can you remember the first time you ever saw a dog and you said, I didn't know a dog can do that? Because I can remember very clearly watching my first time seeing sighthounds run. And literally, I'm not exaggerating, my jaw was just totally agape. Like, I could not even believe a dog could move like that. It's amazing.
Oh yeah, the first thing I saw mowed down by a I use that in a positive way, of course, mowed down by a running dog was one of Doug Mummery's Scottish deerhound greyhound crosses, chasing a fox across a stubble paddock at a place called Balranald in New South Wales, which is the southern part of New South Wales. And this fox had probably a 300-meter jump on that dog. The dog's name was Garth, and he was a big red brindle dog with a broken coat. And he caught that fox before it got to the other end of that paddock in probably 400 meters. And that fox was dead as a doornail from the instant that dog touched it. It was amazing. And that was it for me. I thought, how long has this been going on? You know?
Yeah. Yep. I remember the first time I saw it, I was with my now mentor, and I had just gotten my pup. He was just a wee baby, 13 weeks old. I went out with my now mentor and really, really good friend of mine. And man, his dog saw a hare get up and they took off, and I was just like camera blazing and also just totally floored with their speed. And they caught that hare. It was also the first time I'd ever seen a hare caught by a dog. And even though I knew it could be done, I still was like, I kind of have to see it to believe it kind of thing. And oh man, they weren't even my dogs. And I was jumping around in circles. I was so excited. I was hooked right then.
Well, that's it. I don't think any of us choose to be a hunter. It's one of those things. Once you're exposed to it, you know that this is something I want to do for the rest of my days.
I agree. And,
that's just how it is. You can't force somebody to be a dog man, you know.
Totally agree. Think about it,
you've got to be half a lunatic to be a dog man anyway.
I tried to get my brother into it, and it just did not work out. He ended up giving me his female, which I'm so happy about. Thanks, Ryan. So, yeah. But,
That's it. You've always got to skip in your step when you go out there to feed them and interact with your dogs and spend time with them, you know. And I've always said to myself, the day that it becomes too hard or too much work, I'm going to give it away.
Mm.
That hasn't happened yet.
That's good to hear, my brother. That's good to hear. Yeah. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it all. You know, it's impossible. I'm kind of a serial ponderer. I spend a lot of time in the desert alone when I'm working. And so I think a lot, and I just try to think about these big, big questions, and I try to kind of wrap my head around it, and I just can't always. And I think that's totally fine, because I think that gives us good food to keep on imagining and dreaming. And I know that sounds really corny, but I think a lot of the fun of dog hunting is just what's just around that next bend in my career of this lifestyle. You know what I mean? Like what could I breed, or what can I work on? And I don't know. I just love it all. And I love talking to people that have been way ahead of me, because I get to kind of look into the future and see what I have to look forward to. And talking to people like you, Alex, has made me feel really blessed. And I mean that. And so thanks for talking to me.
I'll let you know on a secret. We all still wonder what's around the corner. What will I breed? Where will I go? What dogs will I use? It doesn't change. not as long as you're breathing if you're a hunter.
I got a really inquisitive mind, and I just love to think about that kind of stuff. And it's good to hear. It's good to hear you say that.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we do here, and I won't take up too much more of your time, there's a network of people here in Australia called the Australian Conservation Dog Network, and basically they use dogs. I'm a member of that network. They use dogs, you know, for the protection, I suppose, or to protect native species or threatened species, and to detect predators, to detect cryptic species that we don't know about, we don't know where they are. They're doing fantastic work with dogs. And it's not so much a hunting context as it is the use of dogs in protective native animals. And there's one particular species that I've got a particular passion for, is a thing called a Burramus parvus. That's its Latin name, but its common name is mountain pygmy possum. These things are about the size of a mouse, or a bit bigger, and they live above the snow line in the alpine areas here in Victoria.
That's cool.
And they're under direct threat by cats and foxes. And we use dogs quite a lot to identify the, you know, locations of these cats and foxes and scats, and do scat analysis and all that sort of stuff. I just brought that up to demonstrate that, you know, to everybody that may be listening, there's a lot of good work being done by people with dogs out there. It's not always in a hunting context, but also in a conservation context.
Yeah, and what a great way to introduce people into dog work. I was thinking, first thing that comes to my mind is, yeah, how about search and rescue? You know what I mean? Like, that's hunting in a different way.
it's no different. You're just using the dog's innate ability to do those things that it's born to do. To do the, you know, what we as humans need, you know, to find lost people, or find, you know, lost wildlife or endangered wildlife and predators. There's a lot of good things that can be done, and there's a lot of good opportunities to promote hounds and and those types of dogs in for the future.
Absolutely. And man, that's great. Every time I talk to Australians, I find out about cool new native wildlife I've never heard of. That's a new one. Man, that's a, those, they're cool looking little dudes. I just Googled them.
They're highly endangered, the poor devils. And the introduction of predators such as cats and foxes is probably the thing that's going to end up seeing the end of them in the wild anyway. There's a few that are kept in captivity.
But, that's a shame.
The ones in the wild are up against it, that's for sure.
That's a shame. Well, Alex, we should talk again sometime. I don't want to take up your whole afternoon. I'm over here just geeking out to the maximum. Let me ask you, if you don't mind sharing, you're a member, you are an admin on two really great hound groups on Facebook, and you also have been a great ally and friend of Houndsman XP. So, and first of all, thank you. I appreciate that again. But if you want to plug your pages, you can. Now would be a good time, I think.
Well, it's not so much plugging the pages, but the reason those pages, Hounds Unlimited and Hounds Australia, are in existence is to try to draw together the community, hound hunting community, both nationally here in Australia and internationally, to try to protect, preserve and promote what we have. Because if we don't do that, we're pretty well doomed to failure. So it's just my little way of trying to get things, up front of mind for a lot of people that are out there that are wondering what we're doing, what we're up to.
Well, I was super, super impressed when I saw your pages, and I was honored that you wanted to be a part of Houndsman XP. And I knew that it was curated professionally, and I could tell you were a well-spoken man, and you definitely haven't disappointed. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. Do you have any final thoughts, my friend? And if so, now would be a great time. Anything you want.
Well, look, I just want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to be able to voice what's happening down here, down under in Australia, and the opportunity to interact with houndsmen elsewhere, especially in the US and Europe. You've got a great following all over Australia, and I'm sure across the US. Just keep up the good work, and we'll hopefully this won't be the last time we speak. We might even talk about hunting one day.
If I get down to Australia, I got a hit list of people I want to hit up. And so, this won't be the last time we talk. I can guarantee it. I do a thing called Tailgate Talks on our Patreon page. They're just casual mini talks. Anytime you want to record, you hit me up. We'll chat about anything we want, because I really want to talk to you about some of your wildlife control work you do. I think that is really interesting. And I'd really like to continue talking about that more. So maybe we should talk again sometime soon. What do you think?
I'll look forward to it.
All right, sir. Well, hey, until next time, it doesn't matter if you're releasing your sandbar dogs or if we're coursing those prairie hares. It doesn't matter if we're using our dogs to sniff for any kind of native Australian wildlife or to find people buried in the snow. You follow your hounds and I'll follow mine. Alex, thanks again, brother. I really appreciate it.
Thank you again, Seth. All the best, man.